Good morning, and thank you very much. It's a real honor to be here. I want to start by also thanking Dr. Mack and Ann Mahoney for organizing the session, and I want to recognize what a deep debt we owe to the experts we just heard, Dr. Jones, Dr. Clark, and Michael Botticelli. So I'm up here. I'm going to talk a little bit about what's going on in Boston, but I want to say I'm not the expert in Boston, but and the experts are sitting in the room. So I want to acknowledge the great team that we have, you know, starting with Rita Nieves, who heads up our bureau that coordinates all of our prevention and treatment programs. I also want to acknowledge Dr. Bernstein, Dr. Wally, and Sarah Ruiz, all whom, without whom, you know, we're unable to do this work, as we are unable to do our work without the support from CDC, SAMHSA, ONDCP, and the State Department of Public Health. So really, you know, I'm going to talk about what's going on in Boston, but what I'm really talking about is extensive partnerships that have come together in Boston to try to do work that, while I think we're doing some things well, I'm going to clearly identify that I think there are other areas where we're challenged. So, you know, I'm going to, you know, just shed a little bit of light on some Boston data. I'm going to go really quick, but just so that folks know, you know, it's really important for us to know what's going on in our own city. Unfortunately, you know, we have a lag time on data, which I want to talk about in terms of one of the challenges. But clearly what we've seen over time is that prescription drug overdose mortality in the city of Boston has increased. It's increased really for our subpopulations as well, with the exception of our Latino populations. And again, that's not a statistically significant difference there. But unlike what's being seen in other places, you know, this is an increase that's happening predominantly in communities of color as well as among our Anglo communities. We do have a little bit of data that we get from Dawn that allows us to understand a little bit about non-medical use of pharmaceuticals, particularly in terms of emergency department visits. And I think as you know, other national data shows, you know, we continue to see a trend of increased non-medical use of pharmaceuticals that's resulting in people showing up at emergency rooms for related poisonings and overdoses. And this has happened, you know, across the board, but you'll see, you know, CNS agents are most likely implicated. And if you really start looking at exactly what group of CNS agents, as with the national data, it's analgesics. Oxycodone, as you can see, you know, huge increase. I want to say it's up over 50%, as is the increase around methadone as well, in terms of what people are reporting in their emergency department visits. I also want to talk a little bit about clonazepam, because it's a huge contributor to the problem in the city of Boston and to both emergency room visits, but also overdoses that we pick up through our emergency medical transport system. And as with the national data, it's really clear that in terms of prescription drug abuse, clients in our treatment programs are also much more likely to be reporting a problem with prescription drug abuse than in the past. So we're up to a little over 1 in 5. And prescription drug overdose deaths as a percentage of all drug overdose deaths are now up to 57% in 2010 in the city of Boston. And this is just a similar graph to what we saw in terms of the national data. We see both an increase in the number of treatment clients. We also see the increase in overdose deaths. And there's a huge gap between what we're doing, what we're seeing in treatment, our ability to actually have treatment beds for folks, and what we see in terms of mortality. But what I really want to talk about is sort of what's the public health approach in the city of Boston. And I'm going to do a little bit of a timeline, you know, just to give people a sort of sense of how long we've been trying to work on this. You know, thanks to a lot of support from our mayor, in 2006 we actually launched a Narcan pilot here in the city of Boston. In 2008, we realized that Narcan pilot had to be supported by a much deeper infrastructure than what you're able to supply both in the medical community and at a health department. And we really started working a lot on community-based overdose prevention efforts, and Michael was a benefactor, you know, a huge source of support for us being able to do the work, and I will describe that in a minute. And now in 2012, we're also paying attention to the fact that while we've had great response, it varies neighborhood by neighborhood, and we also have to have a unified city strategy. So I'm going to talk a little bit about each of these. There are four pillars to the work we've been doing in Boston. We paid a lot of attention to increasing education and training opportunities. We believe strongly that there's a role for a health department to play in environmental and policy changes. We want the voice of our residents to be front and center to the work and have supported community coalitions as a vehicle for that. And we want to make sure that everybody who needs treatment has access to the right services at the right time. So just a couple of examples in each of those areas about what we've done. We focused a lot on developing two overdose prevention curricula, and this was Rita and her folks really did an outstanding job on this, that would allow us to actually move training programs through all kinds of different settings. We have a special curriculum that we're using with public safety and law enforcement professionals, and another curriculum that we use for friends and family members of people at risk. We've also for a long time been doing outreach to people who are active users. But these were two new curriculums that really helped us make inroads in both law enforcement and with friends and families, who oftentimes were at loss about what their role could or should be in assisting active drug users. So I want to say it's a huge effort. In the last couple of years, we've trained 130, you know, staff at 130 community-based organizations. This should be 155 police officers, 276 family and friends have come through our training, and we've trained over 1,000 active users. And so this is a fairly comprehensive training program, but at its core, it's about making people feel comfortable administering Narcan and distributing Narcan to people who are around active users. We've also taken seriously, you know, our responsibility is really looking around health equity issues, that you need to pay a lot of attention to the environment, and in particular to, in this area, to sort of the built environment and what it's doing to allow people to successfully either prevent substance abuse from happening in the first place, or addressing people who are using in a helpful and healthful way. So one thing, and again, I want to give a lot of credit to Rita and her staff, is we finally have drug kiosks, permanent drug kiosks at 11 police stations throughout the city. This is pretty much in every neighborhood, and it allows for the safe disposal of potentially dangerous prescription drugs that are sitting at home. I also want to thank our police commissioner for embracing this. Now that we know the details, while this sounds very simple, because there are controlled substances involved, this is actually a very difficult task and requires the law enforcement agency, the police department, to put resources behind this effort. I want to acknowledge, sounds really easy to do. I thought it was really easy to do. Ends up being fairly complicated and required both training and support and the allocation of resources. As Michael noted, we have both a Good Samaritan law in effect in Massachusetts, as well as a prescription drug monitoring program that both are very robust. I want to also thank the mayor, who was behind both of these and, in fact, was actively lobbying to make sure that these got passed. And we also have 6 drug courts in the city of Boston that are active and, in fact, will see nonviolent drug, people struggling with drug addiction who have been convicted or are about to be convicted of crimes associated with their addiction. Some of the work I'm most proud of is the work that Rita and her staff have done around developing no drug coalitions. And we have, at this point, 11 coalitions that represent 12 of our neighborhoods. And I'm just going to give you a little flavor for the kind of work that the coalitions take on. Four coalitions are actively working to improve bystander response to opiate overdose, and so they're very active on using our curriculum and promoting a lot of trainings. And four coalitions are actively working on making sure that folks know about the Good Samaritan Law. It's great to have a law, but if nobody really knows about it or understands it, you don't really see the uptick in calls to 911. So we've had to do a lot of education around that. And the coalitions, this, again, Health Department cannot do this work by ourselves. We just don't have the staff. Without the coalition support, these activities are very, very difficult for us to happen, in the city, and very difficult to get to the right people. We have four coalitions that are implementing strategies so that people have information about overdose prevention activities, and this is really around using and redesigning materials that are appropriate for all age groups around overdose prevention. Five coalitions have really worked actively on promoting sort of the drug, what used to be drug take-back programs, but also really making sure that residents in their neighborhoods know how important it is to get medication you're not using out of the house. And four coalitions have really taken on the what I think is one of the most difficult tasks, which is about coming up with social media tools that will increase the perception of harm of using amongst young people. I really respected what Dr. Clark said about the culture. I think the coalition work that we're doing is probably the best vehicle that we have on shifting the culture and understanding how social norms, in fact, can change, both to embrace the life-saving measures that people need to engage in order to save people's lives, but also to really shift what's acceptable behavior among, particularly amongst our children. I want to acknowledge that we are also a state that recently legalized medical marijuana and are working very closely with our coalitions on how to make sure that once we open our dispensing centers in Boston, that we're very clear about what the message is in terms of medical marijuana versus recreational marijuana, and that there's no slippery slope here in the community about what in fact has now become an acceptable treatment for a very well-defined group of very ill patients, as opposed to a slippery slope around that it's okay to actually have young people using marijuana. So the coalition's, again, very helpful around helping us think through how we can work on these issues. And our Board of Health has actually adopted some of their recommendations in terms of the regulations that are now in draft form that we'll be imposing in the city on anybody who's citing a dispensing center in Boston. We've also have two new state-funded initiatives, again, thanks to the great support from the Massachusetts Department of Public Health. One is we're in the process of doing the assessment now on what kinds of strategies would really work on preventing non-medical prescription drug use amongst young teens in particular. So, you know, I would say everything we see in our youth risk behavioral factor survey indicates that we, too, have a growing number of young people that have found an easy access route to abusing prescription drugs, and that we need to really figure out what the appropriate strategies would be in the city of Boston with, again, heavy involvement from all of our communities. And we're also going to be, as I noted in the earlier slide, we're going to be really looking at sort of what do you want to say is the system of prevention and response to opioid abuse in the city of Boston, and not have, we have a lot of variety now, as you saw. Some neighborhoods are working on one issue, and it's great, and other neighborhoods may be working on something else, but there has to be a guarantee that there's a level playing field, regardless of what neighborhood you're living in or working in the city of Boston. And I think we're going to be using this new grant as an opportunity to really strengthen the partnerships we have, but work towards agreement on what a system will look like around the prevention side of our work that will go across all of the neighborhoods. In terms of access to care, you know, we do struggle. I think Rita and her folks have been in the forefront of culturally competent care, you know, easily accessible. We have treatment programs for Latino women. We have treatment programs for women of color. We have programs that actually accept women and their children. We have programs that work really hard on reunifying women and with their children. But we don't have enough beds. So I want to be clear. We don't have enough beds to meet the demand, let alone what the demand could be if we were opening up the routes towards treatment. But we did develop a new effort here. It's called PASS, Providing Access to Addictions Treatment, Hope, and Support. It is a centralized location in the city of Boston where anybody can both physically go but also call us to get referrals and support for both the prevention side of the work but also to get into treatment, ranging from detox all the way through sober houses. So what we're really trying to do is use this centralized referral and resource center as a place where not only will we be able to make referrals, but we'll actually have real-time data on where beds are available. So one of the most frustrating pieces right now for residents is when you finally decide it's time to seek treatment, you can spend 5 or 6 hours or 1 or 2 days trying to find your bed. And we can spend 5 or 6 hours or 1 to 2 days as providers trying to find out where the beds are available. You literally have to call every single place to figure out whether or not there's a bed available, and that seems ridiculous in this age of technology. So we're working right now on getting a system in place where we actually can track beds in a much easier way and then simplify the referral process, which I think then makes it easier for people to get in when they're ready to get in. We also started a new initiative where we're placing patient navigators in 4 of our community health centers, and I think this builds on the work that's happening at the federal level about understanding the role that the community health centers can play as both a source of screening, but also as a place where we can, in fact, integrate substance abuse treatment programs into primary care and medical homes. So we're really, I think at the front of trying to explore what those models can look like. But we have put staff at 4 community health centers, and one of their main tasks, I'll be honest, is to reach out to folks that we know are in that neighborhood that have had an overdose, and to try to make sure that folks who have already had one overdose are well linked to both primary care but also behavioral health, and that, again, we're using all of our tools at our health centers to both screen but also to appropriately treat people who are struggling with addiction. So, I'm going to close, with the challenges. Nobody likes me to do this. My staff are working so hard, and I want to give a lot of credit to both what's going on in the city and the state, because I think we're doing a lot of things really, really well. We have a lot of challenges, and we have a lot of areas where we need to do a lot better. So I would just want to identify what I think the big challenges are. One is the data. I cannot tell you how discouraging it is to not have real-time data in this day and age about what the extent of the problem is and where you need to target scarce resources. So there are 2 particular areas where it's distressing. One is because Boston EMS, our emergency medical transport system, is part of the public health department, I get an alert every time somebody overdoses anywhere in the city of Boston and a 911 call is made, as does Rita. And that is our only source of real-time data right now that we have. So we know every single day, we know the minute it happens, the minute that there's a transport for anybody who's had an overdose, anybody who's received Narcan, anybody where there's a suspected drug overdose relationship with an injury. And that data is great, but we know it's incomplete because everybody doesn't go through the 911 system to access care. So we need a system that actually allows us in real time to see the emergency room data as well as our transport data in order to better understand sort of the picture of the overdoses and as it changes. And I'm going to tell you how important this is because we now look at it week by week to see where there are spikes, and we actually map everything. So if we see an area where we see increased activity, so we look at it for this week this year and this week last year, and we look at it over time for the last 6 months. And if we see unanticipated spikes, Rita sends out her team to that neighborhood to try to figure out, an outreach team to try to figure out what may be going on. And it's really important, particularly when we've had spikes in deaths, to get somebody out. What we don't have, however, is sort of the more complete picture, particularly of the factors that may be contributing to what we're seeing now, which is increased deaths, increased overdose, and increased deaths. So we've had a lot of success over time with Narcan, but it's starting to fray at the edges. And, you know, I'd personally like to see death review teams, just like we've done for infant mortality, to do them around substance abuse deaths. So that, you know, this involves interviewing friends and families, pulling medical records, looking at the history, so that you can really tease out themes that may contribute better to understanding of what's actually happening now, as opposed to relying on what's a very limited database that really tells us by ICD-9 or ICD-10 codes soon, you know, what are the factors that contributed to somebody's death. And we, you know, those teams, when you bring them together to do those reviews, they include residents, they include social workers, they include physicians, they include the providers. So it's a opportunity to have a really rich database dialogue on what are the themes you're seeing that could then really inform your practices. So I'd like to really push for that and push for support for that at both the federal and state level. You know, we think again that there's issues on prescribing practices that are difficult for us, as now I want to talk as a treatment provider. So I cannot tell you how many people are walking into my homeless shelter, our homeless shelters, and our treatment programs with Klonidip, with drugs that they're being given to take the edge off their withdrawals or their treatment. And then those drugs are circulating in our programs, and they're being taken by people for whom they're not prescribed, and they're being taken by people for whom they're prescribed in a way that they weren't prescribed to take them. And it's a very perplexing problem. And again, you know, we are bringing together providers in the city of Boston to actually talk about, you know, what really should be the prescribing practices that make the most sense for people who are struggling with addictions and on the road to recovery, or trying to be on the road to recovery. Because this practice of giving people more drugs isn't necessarily working, and it's making it hard for us in many of our treatment facilities to actually control the environment so that we actually are offering a drug-free environment. There's also, as everyone has noted, there's limited access to medication-assisted treatment programs, and we laud the efforts to get our community health centers much more involved in being places that can support medication-assisted treatment programs. One issue, and you know, Dr. Bernstein and I have talked a lot about this, is getting some uniform clinical protocols in the emergency rooms in particular. So if I look at the data when somebody dies, I have yet to see a person who has died from an overdose in the city of Boston that has not shown up at an emergency room for a prior overdose in the last year. When I looked at, it's not like we have deaths every day, but the deaths that we do have, you can definitely see by a pattern, by looking at sort of just our transport data, that people have already been seen in an emergency room. And I will be honest, we had 4 deaths in the last 6 months where people had been seen in an emergency room somewhere between four days and 2 days prior to an overdose that then resulted in a death. So obviously overdosing, having one overdose and surviving from that overdose is putting you at much greater risk of then having a fatal overdose. And we have to do a better job working with our emergency rooms on making sure that as people leave our emergency rooms, and we know they're in a rush to leave, but as people who have had an overdose are leaving the emergency rooms, we've given them some interventions and some aftercare that really helps us, to the best of our ability, prevent a fatal overdose from occurring subsequent to that emergency room visit. And we're continuing to try to adopt sort of standards of care here in Boston that all the emergency rooms can agree to on that. And then, you know, we would like to see integrated health curricula, obviously, K through 12. As a former principal, We do not have good curricula in the high schools even, but certainly would like to see this actually starting K through 12, and are trying to work with our public schools as they develop standards around the health curricula that they are going to be using, a comprehensive health curricula, that it does not leave out the prevention efforts that need to start early around substance abuse, behavioral health, emotional well-being, all need to be fully integrated. You know, we're piloting a curriculum right now in elementary schools around social and emotional well-being. I think this is a really important collaborative effort to preventing substance abuse, is really striving to create environments where children, very young children, feel very supported and have opportunities to manage their emotions appropriately. And with that, I'm going to close and just say thank you, everyone.